This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WBXU. I'm Michael Monks. Earlier this morning, I spoke with author Adam Cohen, whose new book explores the impact of the Supreme Court's rightward political shift over the past 50 years and how that shift has exacerbated America's gap between the rich and the poor. Here's our pre-recorded interview, but we need to note to our listeners that his voice was strained during the interview because he's been speaking on this book tour. The name of the book is Supreme Inequality, the Supreme Court's 50-year battle for a more unjust America. The author is Adam Cohen, and he is our guest today. Adam, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
You know, we're taught about the Supreme Court as an equal branch of government through different levels of civics class over the courses of our educational career, but you write in this book, Supreme Inequality, that the court over the past five decades has disenfranchised voters, allowed more money into campaigns, and even contributes to the nation's mass incarceration. So I'm just wondering if we could start with your thoughts on the way we as the general public and perhaps even us in the media who don't cover the Supreme Court closely, how we talk about the Supreme Court and whether we fully understand its power and what might be at stake.
Sure. I think we don't know a lot about the court itself or the people on it. What we do hear is some of the major decisions they make. So, you know, in school, we learn about Brown versus Board of Education. We learn about maybe the Miranda decision, which created the right to a warning from the police before you're questioned, things like that. So we tend to get those high points from the court. And we don't really get a lot of the day-to-day what they're doing in other areas, particularly things like corporate law, where they actually are very tilted towards corporations and away from individuals, or employment law, where they're very tilted towards employers and away from workers. I think we get a lot of the good news and not so much of the bad news.
And I'll note for our listeners that Adam is a little under the weather after doing his press tour for this new book, Supreme Inequality. We do hope you get the feeling better, but that will explain why you sound a little rough this morning. And so we do apologize that we're taking a little bit of time from your recovery, but we'll get through this together. I note, of course, that this book takes a look at the court from the past 50 years. Why is this period so significant?
Sure. In 1969, Richard Nixon took office. And before Nixon was elected, there was a liberal court, the Warren Court, that had been ruling really in favor of the little guys in our society, in favor of workers, in favor of people accused of crimes. And then when Nixon was elected, he promised to change the court from liberal to conservative and to begin appointing justices who would make it a different court from the Warren Court. And he was able to do that quite quickly because the Chief Justice at the time was already about to resign. So Nixon replaced Earl Warren, the liberal Chief Justice, with Warren Burger, a Chief Justice who had a very different point of view. And then Nixon got an extraordinary opportunity to appoint a total of four justices in 3 years, which completely changed the direction of the court. And that's actually the court that we're living with now. That conservative court with a conservative Chief Justice has gone on for 50 straight years. We've had only Chief Justices like that. We've had Warren Burger, then William Rehnquist, and then John Roberts, the current Chief Justice. And there's always been a conservative majority. And if you think about it, during that time, Congress has gone back and forth between the two political parties. The White House has gone back and forth. But we've had a singular ideology on the court for 50 years. And it's had a real profound effect on a lot of policies in our country.
And that was something I wanted to ask you about, because as you note, over the past 50 years, the White House has changed hands multiple times between Democrats and Republican, as have both chambers of the Congress. But what has kept the conservative justices the majority on the Supreme Court?
Well, it's been a number of things. Partly, it's been just that the Republicans have been in the White House a little bit longer, but also they've been much more focused on holding on to that majority than the Democrats have been on establishing their own majority. So it's manifested itself in a number of ways. One is that the conservatives on the court are just better about handing off their seat to another conservative. And if you think about it, a few years ago, Anthony Kennedy stepped down when he was in apparently good health, and there was no particular reason for him to, but it was the last time he knew that he could for sure resign with a Republican, Donald Trump, as president, and a Republican Senate. He didn't know if the Republicans would hold the Senate in 2018. So he did that handoff very effectively. Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Steve Breyer, when they had the opportunity to step down in the Obama administration, did not. And it's not to say that they should have, but it's just Republicans are much more focused on that. And then, of course, there is the Merrick Garland seat that we all know about, how President Obama nominated Merrick Garland when Justice Scalia stepped down. And Mitch McConnell, the Republicans, would not hold a hearing on him. If Garland had been confirmed by the Senate, that would have actually created the first liberal court in the entire time since 1969. But as we know, the Republicans never acted on Garland, and instead we got a conservative, Neil Gorsuch, fill that seat when Trump was elected.
I want to talk a little bit about that Merrick Garland nomination from President Obama and Senator Mitch McConnell's role in that, because it seems that some of the significant cases that you explore in this book do in some way trace back to the senator. So Senator McConnell, of course, very famously blocked Merrick Garland's nomination as President Obama was set to leave office, leaving that appointment to President Trump the following year. But McConnell's name was on a pretty significant legal battle that landed at the foot of the Supreme Court. It was Senator McConnell against the Federal Elections Commission as it relates to campaign financing. He was on the unfavorable end of that decision, but was later saw part of that decision overturned with what we know as Citizens United. Can you talk a little bit about Senator McConnell, those cases, and the role he's played in maintaining the conservative lean of the court?
Yeah, I mean, I do think, you know, you've really pointed to something there, that the court has been an ideological battle, and we don't think of it that way because we think of the court as being a legal institution, but it's been a site of real entrenched ideological battle. And I think you have to say that Mitch McConnell is probably the leader in many ways of the conservative movement. I mean, we think about presidents and we think about, you know, intellectuals of various kinds, but it's really been Mitch McConnell who has wielded the power of the Senate. And as you say, even himself been a plaintiff in the campaign finance cases to try to, you know, bring about conservative victories. And, you know, he's done that to some extent, because we discussed how with blocking Garland that absolutely changed the course of the ideology of the Supreme Court, perhaps for many years to come. But also as a litigant in the campaign finance cases, but also he's helped to obtain financing and support for the anti-campaign finance movement in general. I mean, there are think tanks and there are places where people are plotting up the next move to try to strike down more campaign finance laws. And McConnell has been very central to that. And they've been incredibly effective. I mean, you know, what people may not understand is that after Watergate in the 70s, Congress actually responded in a very good and strong way by passing a strong campaign finance law. And we would have that law today, which would have strict limits, not only on how much you can give to a campaign, but how much you can spend in elections. It was the Supreme Court that ruled that the spending part of that violated the First Amendment. And in a 1976 case, Buckley versus Vallejo, they said that money is speech. Well, we're still living with that now. And when we look at all the spending going on in the current presidential campaign, it's directly attributable to that line of cases. Now, Mitch McConnell wasn't around in 76 when that movement started, but he's been a major force in the continuation of this movement to strike down campaign finance laws. And as we said, you know, Citizens United took that to a whole nother level, because until then, this idea that corporations had the right to spend their money for their preferred candidates was anathema in the law. But McConnell and his allies won that very important victory for their side in the court.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our guest is Adam Cohen. He's the author of the new book, Supreme Inequality, the Supreme Court's 50-Year Battle for a More Unjust America. Adam, we started to touch on this a little bit ago as this 50-year period that you explore traces back to Richard Nixon. And I was struck while reading this by Nixon's obsession with reshaping the court. It seems that he understood well the type of influence and legacy building that could come from the appointments. You note that he ultimately got to appoint 4 members to the Supreme Court. Can you talk about his philosophy as it applied to the court? I know that you said previously that Nixon even checked on the medical condition of some of the older justices, hoping that they wouldn't last very long.
Yes, that's correct. He was always counting noses and looking for who might be someone he could replace. And, yeah, I mean, Nixon was, you at that point, the leader of a conservative backlash against the Warren Court. And the Warren Court had been doing things like making sure that criminal defendants who were accused of crimes had a lawyer, had warning before they were questioned. And the Warren Court was, of course, leading the integration movement. And, you know, after Brown versus Board of Education in 1954, in the 1960s, was really integrating schools and other institutions across the South, ending Jim Crow. It was taking over, in some cases, institutions like prisons and mental hospitals and making sure that the inmates were treated well. Well, you know, these were things that, you know, Nixon didn't want the courts to play that kind of a role. He believed in, you know, in more executive power. And also, he just wasn't really supportive of that kind of social reform of the 60s. And the court was really at the center of that social reform. So he wanted a court that would stop all that. And the four justices he appointed all were very much in that mold.
And we'll note again that we are talking to Adam Cohen, the author of the new book, Supreme Inequality. He's a little under the weather after talking a lot for this press junket he's doing, talking to a lot of members of the media about this book. We do hope you get better soon, but we apologize that you're a little under the weather today for our interview. I do want to talk about the court today and what the court looks like as you see it under the chief justiceship of John Roberts.
Yeah, well, we've had a conservative court, as I said, for 50 years, but it just experienced a major change with the departure of Anthony Kennedy, because Kennedy was a conservative and quite conservative in some areas. He wrote the Citizens United decision, but he was also a disappointment to conservatives on a number of issues, including on gay marriage or gay rights and same-sex marriage, on race and affirmative action. When he left the court, there was a lot of pressure on President Trump to replace him with a true conservative, in quotation marks, and Brett Kavanaugh was chosen with that in mind. So it's quite possible that we're about to see a sea change on the court just with the arrival of Kavanaugh instead of Anthony Kennedy, and we might see that on issues, on some very important issues, including affirmative action, which in the end, Anthony Kennedy wasn't willing to really aggressively end affirmative action the way I think the Chief Justice may want to. It could be there are five votes for that. It could be there are five votes to, if not overturn Roe v. Wade, very, very sharply limit access to abortion. It's not clear there are still five votes on the court with the replacement of Kavanaugh for Kennedy for same-sex marriage, because Kennedy was the crucial fifth vote on that. So we may see already with this court a major change on important issues. If President Trump is reelected and gets another nomination, for example, if Justice Ginsburg, who's well into her 80s, were to step down, we might see even more of a sharp shift to the right on the court.
You do explore a little bit that, despite what we may expect from certain justices based on their perceived ideologies, that they do occasionally cross over onto the other side when delivering opinions. You may have just noted a couple there, but what do you think in recent years has been the more significant decision where maybe a justice surprised the public?
Sure. I mean, certainly the one that jumps out is the one we've already mentioned, which is that Anthony Kennedy has really not followed the conservative party line on gay rights and same-sex marriage. So he's been the critical vote on that. But we've also seen some of the liberal justices occasionally vote in a conservative way. And one big example of that is Justice Stevens, who, although he was appointed by Gerald Ford, who's a Republican, became one of the real major liberal justices for many, many years. He wrote the decision in the voter ID case, which was a critical case for liberals challenging Indiana's voter ID law, which was one of the strictest ones in the nation. And the plaintiffs in that case said that many voters in Indiana just did not have the kind of government ID you needed to vote. And Justice Stevens, for the court, said that the ID law was okay. So you do see it in both directions. But even saying that, the degree to which this has been a 5-4 court on important rulings for many, many years, even decades, is quite striking.
Can you see any future where there's more balance, perhaps, in the court, where it's less politicized?
Well, we might, you know, I don't think we'll get that if Donald Trump is elected, because he's under such pressure from conservatives to appoint not just a conservative, but a very, very pure conservative. If there were a Democrat elected, particularly a more centrist Democrat, you know, it would be interesting if we once again, they would make different appointments. It'd be interesting if we once again got a court that really had a center. For many years, there were justices in the middle, like Lewis Powell, Sandra Day O'Connor, Anthony Kennedy, to some extent, who created a center that people were not exactly sure which way they would go in elections. It could be that if, as I say, there's a centrist Democrat elected who appoints moderate liberals, that you may begin to see more of that kind of a swing center again.
Our guest has been Adam Cohen. He's the author of the new book, Supreme Inequality, The Supreme Court's 50-Year Battle for a More Unjust America. Adam, please get better. We do appreciate you taking the time and working through that. Very much appreciated. And thanks for sending us the book.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Adam. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Elise Meckler. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. You can find archives of our program online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.